The most amazing thing, the creator of heaven and earth, the God who delivered them out of Egypt, declares that he's going to enter into a covenant with these people. It's not a contract. It's a kind of binding agreement between things which couldn't possibly have any relation to one another, save for this kind of device, something which binds together God and man in a promise forever.
Dr. Cass, our ambition in this series is really to investigate the book of Exodus and to use your fabulous new book, Founding God's Nation, as our guide and commentary. But before we enter into the text of Exodus, I think we need to take a few steps back and ask some preliminary questions. To begin with, why are we searching for wisdom in this very old book, written in a very different culture, with different cultural reference points, different historical reference points, different theological attitudes that are alive to the characters of that book? Why are we reading Exodus now?
Well, first of all, Exodus is a founding text of one of history's most enduring and consequential people, the children of Israel, who have lived on the teachings of this book for 3,000 years. Second, the book has been used throughout Western history as a source of understanding and guidance about politics, about morals, and about human affairs generally. And third, because this is not just a historical account, but, in my reading, a book that can be mined for its enduring wisdom, it is a source for thinking about certain questions that have occupied thinking people always. Why are we here? How should we live? What is a decent and more than decent human community? How does one produce it? What is the relation finally between human beings and the whole and human beings and the divine? And although this is not a treatise, and though we're having a narrative account, nevertheless, through that narrative account of this ancient people in circumstances long gone, one can tease out the questions the text is addressing and see what the text has to say about those questions in ways that will help us think more clearly about those questions as they endure for us.
So if one were to think about analogous works of human wisdom, you might think that, say, Plato's Republic asks a big question about the nature of justice and whether one can found a city on the principles of justice. What's the question, you'd say, that the book of Exodus is asking?
Well, the book of Exodus is asking the question about how to make a people, and not just how to make a people, any people, but how to make a people that will, in terms of the text, carry God's way into the world. God's way being not only of interest to the Jewish people, but of interest to the rest of the world, because as we learn in Genesis, he took up with Israel as an opening for getting his way introduced into human existence, a way that's intended to correct the errors and deformations of human life uninstructed. So we pick up Exodus in the hope that we might understand something about what makes a people, what makes this people, and how the way of life that's outlined here in Exodus, and it is the founding political text, how that way of life addresses the permanent problems of human existence, psychological, social, moral, and offer a way forward in which human life can be elevated, dignified, made more decent, more righteous.
Maybe you could just say a word about how you read this text, because what you just described, the questions you just described, are not the questions that Orthodox religious readers bring to the text.
Correct.
Nor are they the questions that academic scholars of the Hebrew Bible bring to the text.
Right. I describe my my way of reading as wisdom seeking, by which I mean, or I call it a philosophical reading, meaning by philosophical, the love and search for wisdom. Although this text is not a treatise, and it is, although, by the way, Plato's Republic is also not a treatise. It's a dialogue in which a conversation takes place between Socrates and various interlocutors in search for justice, and in a way, search for the question, why should anybody who seeks to be happy care about justice? And then it has to do with exploring the question of justice in the soul and justice in the city and the like. But it seems to me that that someone who's searching for wisdom about a decent and elevated human community, going reading this text, will be looking for a further elaboration of the problems of human existence for which a decent politics, and more than politics, is an answer, and would be on the lookout for how the text, both in its narrative, in its law, and in its ritual, speaks to those concerns. So I don't read this just as a historical narrative, but I read those stories as shedding light on enduring questions and offering clues about how to think about possible solutions.
You know, the reference to the Republic, I wonder if we could just spend a moment thinking about the way that one reads that text. It's necessary, it seems to me, in studying a Platonic dialogue, to try to inhabit oneself in the text. And if one can, this is the reason it is a dialogue, to sympathize with the point of view of various figures in the text as a way to try to give each argument its due and to see how the arguments reverberate against one another. It seems to me that in Founding God's Nation, you attempt to do something quite similar, to try to inhabit with the people of Israel, to try to stand behind Moses' shoulder and look with him at the problems that he's looking at. Do you have anything to say about the way in which you try to live with the text?
Yeah, look, my habit of reading most of the texts that I've taught is, first of all, to assume that the author of the text or whoever put it together knew what he, or shall we say she, was doing in putting this together. And it's controversial to treat the book of Exodus as a book, but that's what I do. I treat it as a whole with a beginning and a middle and an end. And I treat every word as if it matters. I treat juxtapositions and silences as significant or invitational for reflection. But to get to the point of your question, I think that the deepest intention of the book is not what it tells us about its subject, but about what it can create in the heart, mind, and soul of the reader. That the deepest purpose of this story is as a educative text in which it wants to lead the reader to see certain things more deeply and more clearly. And that means that I'm not just trying to learn about the book, but I'm trying to learn from the book. And to learn from the book, you have to inhabit it and allow it to inhabit you. And that means I'm trying to imagine myself. It's a wonderful thing. You have a kind of double vision. If you work at it, you can imagine yourself in the story. You can imagine yourself among the children of Israel, enslaved and then delivered. You can, with a little effort, imagine yourself Pharaoh, who has a large political problem of a teeming multitude of an alien nation rising in his midst and what to do about them. You can certainly try to imagine yourself. It's easy to try to imagine yourself with the human hero of the story, Moses. And with fear and trembling, one can try to imagine what is God up to in the way in which he speaks to each character. So that's a kind of sympathetic entering into the text, and not to see it just as a simple morality tale, but to see it as a live story of people grappling with real issues. But in addition, In addition to being able to try to empathize with the characters in the story, who don't have the advantage of the text. I mean, they didn't read Genesis. They didn't read Exodus. We know things that they don't know as readers. So we have the double vision of reflection, that being distant from the experience that the text gives us by how it relates these various things to one another. But if you do that and you live with the story, it turns out that it can have an effect on you. And I think, and this is perhaps not a common way of reading the Bible, but I regard myself as a living participant in this story and the chief target of the entire enterprise. I and anybody else who picks up the book. The book is aimed to do something to its readers if they only are willing to open themselves up to it, let the book work on them. And I have to say, and we'll probably talk about this later, I always tell my students, whatever text I'm reading with them, we're going to read this book in the spirit that it might have something to show us that would be crucial for our life and we might never get to know if we weren't reading this text. And not because it's going to tell us, but the experience of living with it might show us. And to my great astonishment in working on this book, and especially in the last part of it, that happened to me. I mean, the book that I wrote was not the one I started out to write, but I made discoveries, not so much that I discovered things in the text, but let me add, put it this way. There's what the text says, and then there's what the text does. A text has a deed on the reader, and if you allow it to work on you, it can do something to you. And I hope we can talk in part about what this text has done on this particular reader who's dwelt with this for 20 years with wonderful students in Chicago and Washington and in Jerusalem.
Well, that is, I think, an answer to academic Bible scholars whose main attention in dealing with the text is to try to disentangle various strands of authorship.
Right.
It seems to me that the answer that you've just offered would say something like this to those scholars. You want to say that this verse was written by such an author and that verse is written by another one? You may be right. I'm asking a different question entirely. So that is a way to sidestep quarrels with biblical scholarship.
Correct.
But I don't think that you've escaped the Orthodox religious reader. In trying to inhabit God's point of view, as you've just done, you can do so as reverentially as you like, but how do you treat the figure of God in this book? How should we think about God?
Let me say something first about the religious readers and this kind of reading. I understand the place of this text in the tradition. It has a certain authority. It is most famously read in the tradition as the sort as the source of biblical law, which is binding upon the children of Israel, beginning in the covenant that is enacted at Sinai, and which has sustained this people through 3,000 years, including 2,000 years of exile and so on. And the law is to be obeyed because it was God-given and not to be interrogated. I understand all of that. On the other hand, the law does not require us to lobotomize ourselves. The law, we're invited to meditate on the law every day of our life. The rabbis commented upon the laws. They had multiple interpretations of it. They sought its meaning. And the Bible, in Deuteronomy, it says, Moses says of the laws and ordinances of Israel, this is your wisdom in the eyes of the nations. And when they hear about your statutes, they will say, this is a wise and understanding people. So the text itself says that this is a book that can be mined for its wisdom, even by those on whom the law is not binding. And it seems to me that thoughtfulness about the teaching is not incompatible with obedience. It might, in fact, even deepen the commitments and the attachments. So that is what I think I would say to begin with to traditional readers. There's nothing heretical here, even though it might be more open-minded and more open-ended that they are inclined to be at first. How to deal with the character of God in this story, assuming that I don't already know from my rearing how I should do this. But if I pick this book up as a naive reader, and I read in the first sentence, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." And that's arresting. It's arresting because a voice is talking to me out of the text about something that no human being could have ever witnessed. And I have to ask myself, well, who's telling me this story and is it true? But okay, I'll suspend my disbelief and I'll read further. But there is this figure called God. And he's very important because he's the creator of the heaven and of the earth. And more than that about him, I know nothing as a reader. But I'm interested in him, and I'm interested in him immensely. He's, in a way, the star of the whole story. And how do I know about him? Do I know about him because I bring to the text preconceptions that, of course, he's omniscient and omnipotent and all good and eternal and infinite, etc., etc.? Well, the text doesn't ever tell me those things. In fact, those attributes were given to God by medieval theologians. Instead, I would say, if I'm doing a naive reading, and that's partly I should add, I read naively, I try to forget everything I know that isn't in this book, because I don't want to distort the understanding of the text by importing concepts and concerns that are foreign to it. So, I make the kind of strategic approach. I'm going to use the word God as a, forgive me, placeholder in the text, and allow it to be filled in as I go along by everything I can learn from the text about what God says, what he does, what he wants of us. He's very important. I need to know about him. But I think I'm going to learn from him, from the text, the way the people in the story, and even more than the people in the story, learn about him, because I have inside knowledge that they don't have.
Well, this is where your point about the double vision of reading becomes so important. As we go on and talk about some of the narrative dimensions of Exodus, we'll have to pay attention to what we know as readers about God from Genesis and earlier in Exodus, and what various characters, figures in the text themselves, what we're shown that they know, could be something else altogether.
I think maybe in one of the subsequent sessions we can devote ourselves to this more thematically. But the first thing we know about God from the text is he's the creator of the heaven and the earth. And if we read the rest of that chapter, we know that he creates by speech and distinctions so that it's an intelligible creation. We know that he looks upon things and declares them to be good, so he makes judgments. We see that he is solicitous of his creatures and provides them with food. We learn subsequently that he's a teacher. Later we learn in Egypt that he's rather powerful. We learn that he can provide manna in the desert. That's pretty good. He executes judgment for wrongdoing. And then we get it late in Exodus. Moses gets a revelation when he wants to know much more about God than he knew before. And God reveals a certain softer side, which turns out to be crucial. So the reader is learning, the reader who's open to this is picking up the clues. And part of the unfolding story is not just what happens to the human beings in the story. And in Exodus, not just how do the literal children of Jacob named Israel become the people or children of Israel, but how is the character of God revealed to them through the story of Exodus and revealed to us, the readers? So this is one of the great unfolding threads of the story from which the reader is eager to learn.
This is a gigantic subject. We're going to come back to this subject and spend more time on it in due course. For now, I should like to turn our attention backwards. Standing as we are on the threshold of Exodus, there's some things that I think the reader is expected to have in mind from the text that came before.
Right.
You've already described some things that the reader has learned about God, the creator of the heaven and the earth. But of course, one also learns that God is eager for his way to be brought into the world. And there are various experiments that God undertakes to try to redeem human life. What works? What doesn't? Maybe we could just begin there.
Well, I think Genesis is divided really into two parts. The first 11 chapters are sort of a kind of mythic account of human history before the call of Abraham. And the rest of Genesis is the account of the three patriarchal generations, the generations of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their wives, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. But before one gets to Abraham, one sees one sees what looks like an early history of the human race, but which is through that so-called historical narrative, an account which gives us a kind of anthropology. It shows us the character of human life, both psychic and social, in all its moral ambiguity. And it shows us why human life uninstructed will give rise to difficulty, not to say disaster. So I read those early stories, the Garden of Eden, Cain and Abel, Noah and the flood, Noah and his sons, and the city and tower of Babel, as sort of five moments in which one gets a kind of deep insight into what human life would look like uninstructed, so that we can say, if we had utopian thinking of wanting to go back to one of those, we would say, tried, not very likely. Unsuccessful. So let's look at a couple of them. The Garden of Eden story, which is a different account of the creation than the first creation story, we could come back to that if you'd like. This presents human life in its innocence. The man and the woman are placed in the garden. Everything is there for their delight. There is a certain injunction, by the way, don't eat of this tree of knowledge of good and bad, because if you eat of it, you will die. But everything is wonderful. But of course, that kind of childlike, innocent, and delight in life as such can't last, because curiosity spurs, raises its head. The human imagination, with the help of the serpent, thinks of something different. The temptation to take control of your own life by your own imagination, exercised by looking at the world around you, grows up, and it turns out that the simple, harmonious, unself-conscious life of enjoyment is disrupted. Their eyes were open and they saw they were naked, and they hide from one another their nakedness, and they hide from God. And they are then rewarded or punished for this kind of transgression by being introduced to human life as we know it, and they're sent out of this Edenic, childlike, innocent world to live in a world which has what? No laws, no guidance, etc. And there the first story is human life under anarchy, and the paradigmatic story is the fratricide of Cain upon Abel.
Before you enter into that, let me just establish a bookmark for our listeners. There will come a time soon enough in our discussions when, again, we will be standing before the fruit of the ground, a plant that grows from the earth, surrounded by a snake, at the presence of which an inflection in human history will present itself. That in Eden we saw a snake which inducted mankind into a new way of understanding. And again, in the wilderness, we will again be before a plant, and there will be a snake which will inaugurate a new way of understanding in the world. This is one of the echoes that one will see. I want to establish that, because in our retelling of Genesis now, we're telescoping toward Exodus.
I should say before I go rapidly through the others that what you get really before you come to Abraham is you get, first of all, innocence in the garden, anarchy, the generation of Cain and Abel, which finally issues in the birth of the arts and crafts and war. Then the earth descends into violence and God starts over with Noah. And Noah gets the first law for humankind, permission to eat meat, but an injunction to avenge homicide in the hope that man's lust for blood will be sated by meat eating and he'll stop killing his fellow man. And that life under primitive law is undercut in the very next story when Noah's son Ham celebrates his father's shameful drunken nakedness, and you have filial rebellion instead of filial piety. And then you have a project of the rational project that man could become a god to man through technology, the universal city of Babel and the tower. And that turns out to be a failure with a little help from God, who pushes it to its logical conclusion of the multiplication of languages, of fracture, and so on, the human world in the absence of truly looking up to something beyond. It's against that background of innocence, anarchy, primitive law, but only under paternal rule, and the universal rational city in which man aspires to godlikeness, to godly, to being a god, not just to being in God's image. It's only after one of the reader sees that when Abraham is called, the reader wants to know, maybe there's an alternative to all of this. And God takes up with Abraham as he tells him, among other things, so that he will be a blessing to all the nations of the earth. God hasn't abandoned his concern with humanity as a whole, but he stops working with humankind altogether and tries, in my language, to get a toehold in the world for a way of life that would address all these evils that lurk in human hearts.
And the toehold in the world is through a particular man and his family.
It's through a particular man and his family, and I mean, who knows how many other people God called and they just decided not to go. Abraham was called, go leave your father's house and go to the land that I will show you. And Abraham doesn't say peep, he goes. And he's offered a great promise. I don't think we can rehearse all the generations there, but it is the story of Genesis, the rest of Genesis, is how this toehold, which is consecrated in a covenant between God and Abraham, where Abraham is told, walk before me and be wholehearted. And in exchange, I will make a covenant with you, and your seed will be as numerous as the stars. And your wife, Sarah, this barren woman, age 90, will bear a child, etc. And we get through these three patriarchal generations, narrowly escaping fratricide in each one of them, how this orientation towards the divine survives three generations until at the end of Genesis, thanks to the sibling rivalry between Jacob's two wives, Jacob sires a clan of 12 sons. Thanks to a famine and the providence of Joseph, who is in Egypt, they wind up in Egypt to escape the famine, and we leave them at the end of Genesis, now as a kind of proto-nation, but in the wrong place. So we've seen we've seen something survive three generations in the family. We see them in the wrong place. They are an incipient nation. We've seen, and we should talk about this for a minute, at the end of Genesis, the distinction between Israel and Egypt, anticipating what's coming in Exodus. But the question we're left with really at the end of Genesis is, look, all right, they've multiplied. They now are 70 strong, not counting the women and children. Can we take this from from an intergenerational preservation of a way within families? Can it be taken to a national level? Can this be put on the scale of one people amongst the peoples of the earth who will be witnesses and models of God's way?
So the question for readers of other great texts in the history of the West, this is in a way the question at the very beginning of Aristotle's Politics, wondering how a city comes to be by looking at suburban units.
Right.
Now, the Hebrew Bible has a different answer to that question.
Correct.
But that's a similar question which is being raised at the end of Genesis.
Right.
I actually do want to go back to thinking about Jacob, Israel, and Joseph.
Okay.
And what happens in Egypt. But I don't want to too quickly run over the initial call to Abraham.
Please.
There is one crucial thing I just want to draw out to establish now, something that we'll have to come back to in later discussions of Egypt. Abraham is called, according to the text, by the God of what will become the Hebrews. The Hebrew God, Ivri, it means something crucial. From the man who leaves Mesopotamia and crosses over into the land of Canaan, that somehow this is a God that isn't only a local God. Maybe you could just say a word about what we know from the text about the nature of God from that initial encounter.
Abraham, his genealogy is of interest on this point too. Abraham came from Ur in Mesopotamia, in Babylonia. His father was something of a hippie. His father got up and started to go toward Canaan, but he fell in love with Haran, which was a place of moon worship, and he settled there. And one has to have a sense that Abraham was a guy who was sort of restless. He's I think, uncertain who the God really is. And there's, of course, a midrash which says that Abraham smashed his father's idols because he had somehow discerned. By the way, the Babylonians were the place where people began to measure the heavens. And this is the birth of real astronomy for the sake of astrology. I mean, to study the heavens so that you can govern planting and things down here. Abraham had probably figured out a thing or two, or at least suspected that the orthodoxies where he lived were unknown. And he thought maybe there must be an intelligent source for these unintelligent but beautifully moving objects. And there must be one and not many. But he was also personally restless. He's married to a beautiful woman and he has no children by her at the age of 75. And then this voice calls him and says, go out of your father's house to a land I will show you, and I will make your name great, and et cetera, et cetera. He gets a sevenfold promise. And the promise speaks to the longings of Abraham's soul for family, for name, for a land, for an answer to what rules here. He's not absolutely sure who's talking to him, but he suspends his disbelief and takes a walk. And it's curious, the first thing he does when he comes to Canaan, he builds an altar and calls on the name of God. And I read that as saying, Abraham makes the trip to Canaan and he builds an altar and he says, God, are you still here? Are you only back there? He's in a way testing the question of, is this a local God or is this a God who is more universal? And it's through the adventures of Abraham, of which there are 10, this was the first of them, Abraham comes increasingly to know something of the character of this God. His solicitude, his concern with Abraham, his promise to him, his interest in justice in the famous story about Sodom and Gomorrah, and Abraham learns something about political justice. He's able to plead God down from destroying the whole city to saving it if there were 10 righteous men, but it turns out Abraham stopped the counting then, and God destroys the city, and presumably Abraham learns that political justice is not necessarily entirely just. He learns a whole series of things. Does he learn that God is the God of the heaven and earth? I don't think so.
But he does learn that he is more than a local God.
He learns that he's more than a local God. He learns that he has great power. He learns that he's solicitous. He learns especially that, and the great miracle, is the birth of Isaac. And in the story of the binding of Isaac, in which Abraham, which is his final test, Abraham is being tested to find out now at the end of his travels and his education, did you follow me, Abraham, because you wanted my promise of offspring and greatness of name? Or did you follow me because out of awe and reverence for the promiser? Because now the only tangible evidence of the promise is Isaac. And Abraham, I think, understands what this question is, and without hesitation is prepared to offer up Isaac out of fear and reverence for God. A horrible, horrible story. And is in a way rewarded with an upping of the ante of this promise and the recognition that this God does not, in fact, want human sacrifice, but wants your dedication and your wholehearted devotion, and that that is very different from the demands of the other gods of the ancient Near East.
Okay. With this in mind, again, we'll have to come back. We're setting some groundwork here,
right,
to come back in further subsequent discussions. But the question of whether God is temporally bound to a certain city or a certain region or not will have large consequences in our reading as we go.
Right.
I should like to now turn to the last big thing I want to discuss today, which has to do with what we learn from Genesis about Egypt. Already in the time of Abraham, we learn something about Egypt.
Yeah, we learn about Egypt that Egypt is the fertile place. Whenever there's a famine, go to Egypt. Why? Egypt is, as Herodotus says, the gift of the Nile. Egypt, it does not rain except in the delta. Every year the Nile floods, watering the land, and the land produces like hair on the head. And it's enough. It's a land of good and plenty. It turns out, of course, that Egypt is a place ruled by a pharaoh who rules despotically, and he likes beautiful women. And he rounds up beautiful women for his harem, and that reputation is known. And Abraham tells Sarah when they go down there, please say you're my sister, otherwise they will kill me and take you, etc. So we learn something about that, and sure enough, Sarah is rounded up for the harem, and only by God's intervention does she escape. We learn about Egypt from Joseph. And Joseph is a fascinating character. Joseph is Jacob's favorite. He is anointed with the coat of many colors, which is a designation as the heir apparent and subsequent leader, the beloved son born of the beloved wife, Rachel. But Joseph is Joseph's not simply a member of the tribe. And his first dreams about sheaves of wheat bowing down to 11 sheaves of wheat bowing down to one sheave of wheat, or the sun and the moon bowing down to him. These are, as one of my students pointed out, these are Egyptian dreams. What kind of a shepherd, and the Israelites were shepherd, has dreams of sheaves of wheat? And while Jacob interprets this dream to mean Joseph has fantasies of omnipotence over his family, there is a certain strand in Egypt in which the effort is to make the cosmos do the bidding of the monarch through magic and technology and so on. So Joseph already is geared from the beginning to the place where he will succeed. He would never succeed in Israel, but he succeeds as the prime minister in Egypt. He's clairvoyant. He's a wonderful manager of things. But in the course of it, he brings out certain latent tendencies in Egypt altogether. He consolidates Pharaoh's power. He centralizes the holding of land and stores up all kinds of food in Pharaoh's service. And in the most poignant and pregnant thing of all, he purchases the servitude of the masses as the price for giving them seed grain during the years of famine. So, and then in I think the most So, I mean, what we really see is we have intimations of the kind of Pharaoh we're going to meet in Exodus, in a Pharaoh who commands, who welcomes absolute power and being ministered to, and is worshipped by the people as a god among them. We see that the women are for pleasure and not for generation. And in the last story, we learn something about the Egyptian attitude towards mortality. And the last chapter of Genesis is just stunning. It contrasts the death and burial of Jacob in the ancestral cave at Machpelah, where Abraham had buried Sarah, having purchased this cave. It's the only remnant of the Israelites' claim in Egypt, in Canaan, during the 400 years of servitude in Egypt. We have the funeral of Jacob contrasted with the death and the mummification of Joseph, which is the last word of Genesis. And Joseph was embalmed and placed in an ark, B'Mitzrayim, in Egypt.
So what's the difference between being buried in an ancestral plot among one's forebears, right, and mummification?
Right. Mummification is for the sake of the mummified. It's an attempt to arrest decay and to control change. It is, if you're a high-ranking person, and only the high-ranking people like Pharaoh and Joseph got mummified, it is awaiting reanimation. It's in the surface of a return to life, which I was going to say God willing, but magic willing, the Pharaoh's magicians will, who are working on it, will find the way to reanimate the dead. And you can see, well, you can and reanimate the dead. Burial is not death-defying or death-denying, but is death-accepting. It accepts the fact, as we are told early in Genesis, dust to dust. But it responds to that fact, that sad fact of life, by embracing generation, by embracing procreation. No, we cannot have immortality for ourselves, but the immortality that's open to us, if we are open to it, is to participate in the eternal propagation of a way of an eternal people in relation to the eternal God who has taught them how to live. Egypt is a place concerned with mortality, not with morality. The Jewish alternative way is the way of righteousness to be taught generation after generation, and that means family rather than self-fulfillment, rather than the preoccupation with one's own existence.
To the terrors of mortality, which are universal for humankind, Egypt and Israel offer very different answers. Now, the relation that those answers will have in the formation of a people is something we should take up in our next discussion. Maybe you can just set the table for us by sharing some of the questions that we'll raise in the course of that discussion next time.
We come to the end of Genesis with Israel in Egypt. They've gone down. We have a little hint when we were told early in Genesis, Abraham was told, and we listened in, that no, you're not going to inherit this land. Your people will be strangers in a strange land and oppressed for 400 years before they will come back. So we have this prophecy, and we see them in Egypt, and we're thinking maybe Egypt is the place where this prophecy is going to be fulfilled. And in the very last, one of the last things Joseph says to his brothers, he goes to his embalmed place in his ark. He tells them it's the most poignant thing. When God remembers you and takes you out, please take me with you. And by the way, they will. So there is an anticipation of eventual deliverance from Egypt and a return to the land. But right now, at the end of Genesis, Israel is in Egypt. And family has survived. There hasn't been fratricide, but it was a close call. We've got a founding here, not like Romulus and Remus or Cain and Abel, who's Cain is the founder of the first city and the first fratricide. We've got something started that hasn't been founded in sin. And the question is, how can this people be formed? What will it take to form them? Why would God start to form them in slavery, which is going to happen to them? Why is that the beginning rather than, as Aristotle would say, naturally growing up from family to village to town to city in an organic way? What will it take to make a people out of them? And finally, what does this have to do with Egypt? Why Egypt? The anticipation we have from the last chapter of Genesis is that Israel is going to be defined in, out of, and against Egypt as the anti-Egypt. If Egypt is the greatest civilization of the world that knows not the God of the Bible, then Israel has to have an encounter with that. There has to be a contest with that in order for Israel to start on its path to God's new way.
Those are the questions we'll start with next time. Dr. Cass, thank you.
Thanks very much, John.